Okay, we're sitting in Gunter Hampel's living room in the East Village. Last time I spoke to Gunter was maybe 7 or 8 years ago, doing an interview for All About Jazz. And hi, Gunter. It's good to see you again.
How are you?
I'm crazy like you are. Okay. Great projects, too many projects. Well, you were telling me a little bit ago about you wanted to do a book, The Life of Gunter Hampel.
No, it's Gunter's called Life. My Gunter Life.
My Gunter Life.
That's what the book is going to be named. Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Tell you about it. I'm a secret writer. Don't tell anyone.
Okay.
I always wanted to be a writer. And so the attempt which I'm doing since 40, 50 years is that I write something down whenever something seems to be extraordinary or something in my life, like I've met Thelonious Monk, and after I wrote down all the little details of our meeting, tried to memorize all our great conversations. Nelly was there too, his wife. And and when I read these things now, or if I show it to anyone reading it, they are very excited. So this is one of my... And also I'm writing essays and poetry, because when you are a composer, then writing is something on the line, so to speak. You know, it's the same procedure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you remember any Thelonious Monk stories you could tell?
Well, it's not a story. It's a meeting between some heavy... people, you know. I was introduced to him. That was right after I'd made the Heartlands album, so that was 1965-66, and he was in town, and my management, they also did this recording, did the concert with Thelonious. So they wanted me to come there and said, we want to introduce you to Thelonious, that he knows we have some musicians here too who go in their own way. So in the intermission of the concert, I was asked backstage, and then I met Thelonious Monk. And he looked in my eyes, and then... he said, I want to talk to you. So after the concert, he asked me, actually it was like this, it was all a kind of tohu-bahu after the concert. So I already went to my car and was just going home. You know? But he came, when he saw me, he came running all over the street and said, Gunter, Gunter, Gunter. So I had to go with him to the hotel. And we had some deep conversations, like, you see, there are a lot of people who copy Monk in Europe, right, or elsewhere. And I always thought, well, copycats is not the big thing. You know, I rather always searching out musicians from which I can feel and see and hear that they're doing their own thing. Because if I meet people who are talking about from the inside with their music, then I'm getting better results. But the first thing Monk was asking me was, which cats do you know who copy me? And so I was like, oh yeah, there's this guy here, and this guy there, and this guy there, and I was not... so nice speaking about them, because, and I thought Monk wanted to put them down too, to copy his stuff, but it was just the opposite. He said, the more people copy my music, the more my music gets around. And the more people get used to my sound, and the more I'm going to be successful. So that was maybe one of the things which is a very surprising answer, I would say.
Another famous music person that you worked with was Hans von Ahense. Could you tell me about your interaction with him?
Yeah, you're pinning out something after we had done the work, my band and his work. Willem Breuker was in my band at that time, and we had done a lot of working also with classical composers and stuff. But with Hansel, I would say this was the top of a collaboration between improvising jazz musicians and classical composers who, well, their métier is to write every scribble down, and then you look for musicians who can play that. So with Hansel, yeah, see, I got Hansel. I had met Wolfgang Fortner before that. And if you might know, Wolfgang Fortner is one of the teachers of Hansel. Right. And they were down at the conservatory or new music school, whatever you want to call that, in Freiburg down there. And that was a very, very incredible meeting I had there with Wolfgang Fortner and his class, because in his class was not just Hans Werner Henze, but another 12 or 15 other great people who became very known composers after that. So we played a concert at the Freiburg University. And my band was with Miriam Brown, Steve McCall, Gene Lee, Ambrose Jackson on trumpet. See, Marion and me, we had a group which we were co-leading at that time. And a funny thing happened. At the same, we were recorded by the radio. Mm-hmm. And they gave us something like $2,000 or something. But before the concert, we had word that Ken Bolederly was being recorded by the same radio station, and they didn't give him 2,000, they gave him 20,000. So my musicians, they protested. They didn't want to play for that radio. They didn't want that 2,000 to give to us, because they said they don't deal with us equally. I tried to explain to them that Ken Bolederly has a more public success than we with our free music. So, but they said, no, we're not going to play. I said, no, how am I gonna do this here? I have the radio, I have the audience, I have you here. Yeah, you tell us what we are supposed to play. So I grabbed Marion's saxophone and played him. Okay, you play this. I went to Steve McCall's drum set and played and said, you play this, you know. And to Gene, I said, okay, you know, I mean, like, I didn't know what to do. This right. was a very strange situation for me. I mean, well, these things happen sometimes, you know. But while all this was happening, Hans Werner Henze, he was standing there and he was watching us, how I was dealing with these people, mm-hmm. with my friends, right? How I was dealing with my friends. I had to go. They were like these childs who didn't want to play, right? And I had to show them what to play. But then after 5 minutes, they gave up, you know, because we were friends. It was just a thing. So we had an incredible concert there. And after the concert, Wolfgang Fortner and Hans Werner Henze and all this, there's this flute player and teacher. I can't remember his name right now. But after it, they were all sitting together, like these old German professors, you know, in this room, and everyone was drinking beer and stuff. And while we were all there, and they started to take our music apart in order to understand what we were doing there. Uh-huh. And then I heard Wolfgang Fortner say, oh, he admired the way, like Marion, as an Afro-American, the way like he touches the drums when he's playing the drums. He's not just banging them or stuff. So he tried to make his students aware about the difference, how you approach playing an instrument as a jazz musician who loves what he's doing. Not that the classical people don't love what they're doing, but they go from their mind, so off from their brains, whereas we go from our heart, we go from the feelings we got and put this into our music. And they got that. You see, it's not that they don't want it, they just don't know how to get there, where we are getting, because they are trained so much by history and the way like it's been done all over the centuries, that for them, us improvising this free music, which they are all writing down and trying to get the same sounds together, right? And we come in there and we just open ourselves to each other and play with each other. The team was working, and our correspondence, our calls and answers, and our communication in collective music. They didn't know how we did this, but Henze and Fortner, they got this very well. I was amazed, you know. I didn't know they could get to it, and so Henze decided to use my band for one of his pieces, because I left a big impression there with, well, in this case, it was more my music than maybe from the band members, because they wanted me to tell them what to play, you remember? So that was a very weird situation, but what came out of it was that I got a call from Hans, and he said, please come to Berlin. I'm planning to do this piece, and I'm planning to put you in. So I want to know how you guys work and how I should write and how you communicate. You know. So I went there a couple of times, and I was living in Paris at that time. Mm-hmm. And so I had the great pleasure to sit with Hans-Werner Henze and Stomu Yamashita. That was the drummer who was on that recording as well. It's on Deutsche Grammophon. We recorded it much later in Rome, in Italy.
Yeah, he did a piece that was written for the North Vietnamese that Henze wrote, a solo percussion piece. Yes, Stomu Yamashita did.
Oh, he did that, yeah. Yeah, yeah, they worked together. This is why he was also put on the bill, because at that time I had a group with no drums. So he said, oh, I have this Stomu, that is perfect. I wanted to get him anyhow. So I was sitting with Stomu Yamashita and with Hans-Werner Henze. And with there was a main singer. I mean, like one of those classical, you have a and then Steinberg, this kind of Sprechstimme, we say, right? But also sing, you know. So he was so we were sitting in the famous Berlin Philharmonic Hall, and we were on stage. There was no one else in the whole hall, and there was this the music script. So that Hans-Werner Henze was singing some of those lines, which there were a lot of more musicians than us. There were three different groups, Fires of London, which is a kind of classical woodwind and string group. Then there was a whole brass section there, another famous classical group. They were also from London. And they were all brought to Germany to play in the Deutsche Opera in Berlin. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a joint where no jazz musician has played before and after us, you know, because it's a total, almost fascistic institution, you know. I mean, so, but these three voices from Henze and Stomu Yamashita and from that singer, they were so precisely reading those lines. They were so precisely in tune. They were so precisely in time with everything. I mean, just to hear those three singing through his scripts was alone worth the whole endeavor, you know. And I did then with my voice and the parts he had written out for me, you know, but I was not so precise like them because they are much more trained, you know. So we did then two performances in Berlin, right? And we had 1 week of rehearsals. And during this course, I more and more asked Henze, look, we don't need to play all this, what you wrote down there, because it was some difficult shit. Show me the syntax of it. Show me, you know, what you want. What do you want to be expressed? And we do it. And he looked at me like he never had anyhow asked him that kind of question, you know. And so we were supposed to improvise anyhow, but now we started much earlier to improvise than he had written out, because we caught more up with what was going on and had so more of a life relationship to the way like it was being played. And it was so great what we did together with what he wrote, that the other musicians, I mean, from the symphony orchestra and those classical groups, they always checked and they came to our partitures, is that what you say?
Scores.
Scores, yeah. Because they thought Henze had rewritten them overnight.
Oh.
They couldn't imagine that anyone could improvise that. You know? And then when they found out that we could improvise that, what they, in lots of work, you know, I have to repeat from the scores, the awe was very big. So the director from the opera, from the Deutsche Opera, he came to me and said, "Hey, Gundarnberg, whenever you write an opera, first come to me here in the Deutsche Opera, because I want to be the first who is going to publish, let you perform it here." You know? But I haven't written my opera yet.
Why not?
Because I didn't have no time. I'm so busy. And I thought when I'm getting older, I will have more time to do all this, you know, writing. Because as long as I can get away with improvising, I don't need to have all this work to do, you know. So that's... And also Jean is gone. See, Jean was in... I had written a space opera, right? I mean, like I'm as a writer and philosopher and whatever attributes I have. See, I'm trying to figure out how all this life is coming together here on this planet. Mm-hmm. What all sources are making this?
Right.
And my opera is about this. It's about all these energies, from not imaginary things, but from what really is going on between the forces of the universe and the forces of Earth. Because of these two forces, we have come to be human beings.
Mm-hmm.
Some people say we come from distant stars. Might be possible, but the human being, as it's in its form as it is a total result of the energy flow which goes on between the Earth and the Sun. And the Sun, again, is only a kind of representative for the energy of the universe we are having. It's not coming through the Sun, but the Sun is one of the symbols which attracts this energy here, our star. So the more I learn about those big secrets, see, I'm from Germany, and when I finished my schooling, those teachers, you see, you get a diploma when you are about 18 or 19,
mm-hmm.
and with it, diploma, you are entitled to go on the university to study. It's not like here that you can go on already to a college when you're 16 or whatever. No, you first have to go through schooling till you are 19. And when I was getting my diploma, my piece of paper, then the director from our school, he said, we have showed you now what we know about life, but we want you to keep your eyes open and live your own life with the experience you are getting. So that's some heavy shit, you know. And this is my background. I like to know. If I don't, then I ask questions, and if I don't get answers, then I don't rest until I find out myself. This is how I got my whole music together.
Yeah. Well, what do you find as a source of energy for your creativity?
The source of the energy. Well, let me first introduce you to those layers of energies which we are all exposed to.
Okay.
I mean, our world, if you ask our religions, any religion, they always speak from good and evil, or from God and the devil. So these seem to be the two exponents around which everything, at least for our understanding, is polarized. Mm-hmm. So we say, like if you use yin and yang, I mean, God is yang and the devil is yin. Or the day is yang and the night is yin. Or male is yang and yin is... But these two forces, they need each other. You see, God wouldn't be God if the devil wasn't there. And because all these energies from which we right now are talking are not a static, constant pile of energy. This energy is what maybe this yin and yang sign is always turning around, like the earth is turning around. Mm-hmm. Like what is yin becomes yang, and what's yang is becoming yin. And between these changes, I mean, change is the only constant thing, right?
Right.
And this changes happening in everything which is alive, be it us, be it a tree, be it a bird, or be it the wind or the water or the elements. I mean, we all have certain energies which are in constant flow. And when we zap into our energy to be creative, when you are lucky like me, you find a way to zap into the energy which is the creation. The energy of the creation. And the energy of creation, the source of it, is love. Because all of our being alive and everything else being alive here on this planet happens because the energy of the universe, religions say that is God, and the energy of the earth, they are in love with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And they are fucking all the time. They don't stop. They are in a constant way of sharing their love with each other, meaning the energy of the universe and the energy of the earth is in constant creation of life.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that this started, our scientists, they say, okay, this whole Big Bang that started billions of years ago, and now it's expanding. So that's what they tell us. But that's not the picture. They're both here, those energies, or millions of these energies are here, and they are constantly in this love-making out of which the creation in us gets a constant nourishment. And when you play music like we do, and I want to, and I'm going to give you another record from my new band I have in Germany, because I've changed a lot of my musicians, because the old musicians, they are so fucked up. They don't have no money, they don't have no jobs, and when you talk to them or when you are on stage with them, they are sagging. And they're I mean, I'm talking about Germany, right? So I rather use some fresh musicians who mm-hmm. still have all the hope going for them. So the band which I'm having now is my European trio plus bass, so we are a quartet now. And all the saxophone player, his name is Johannes, I found him when he was 17. I did a big band workshop in Dresden, and you know about the drummer who is the head of that school. Baby Sommer, you've heard his name?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so he asked me to come to his school with my big band arrangements because he had problems with his big band teaching there. So he needed me as an expert with all those horn players and all this stuff to bring my charts and then do all these improvisations. And I got another job with another big band in the city, but this was not the music high school
mm-hmm.
or the music university, I must say. That's what it is in Germany. But it was a little orchestra from a smaller school. Let me see, just a regular music school, like 3rd Street Music School here right. on 11th Street. So when I came, after I was done with the one at with Baby Sommers, which went beautiful. I mean, like, we did the final concert there, and there were 400 people listening there. When we played there, I can't give you all the details, but it was fantastic. So I had a good feeling going to this other orchestra, and that was the next day in the morning at 8. We were supposed to do something from 9 till 11. So when I came there, there was a whole big band there from that school. The youngest one was a drummer. He was 12 years old.
Wow.
And his dad was playing the trumpet in the same orchestra. And next to me was standing the 17-year-old Johannes, and his dad was playing also. They both playing the saxophones. And that's the whole group was like, youngest kids, their parents, in other words, they had more love for the music than those guys on the university. Because on the university, I asked around, you know, I mean, why did these people want to be jazz musicians? You see, they love to be a jazz musician, but their parents tell them, okay, when you want to be a jazz musician, we give you a good solo education. You go to these universities or jazz schools or whatever, but most of them, they don't like to go there. So this is why Baby Sommer has all these problems in getting through to them.
Mm-hmm.
They are there, they get paid for by maybe their parents, or they get a grant to study it, but only very few take it really serious.
Mm-hmm.
But these kids and their fathers, when I came there, see, they usually play Count Basie arrangements from the 20s out mm-hmm. of where it was, Detroit, or where was Count Basie?
Hamilton.
But you know, what does a 12-year-old in East Germany know about what Count Basie did in the 20s? How can he ever be able to synthesize the music of the black people in the 20s of the last century. How can they play? How can they feel it? How can they put their energy into it? They have no connection to that.
So how do you approach that?
So they get totally written down arrangements. They even write the solos down from the soloist. So this 15-year-old saxophone player, he has to learn how to play like the saxophonist from Count Basie 130, 150 years ago or whatever. And so how do I approach it? See, I sometimes don't even have a drum chart because the melody indicates so clearly what you play and where you hit it, that you can read from the melody charts or from a piano chart. So I don't tell the drummer what he actually is to be, except when I write some complicated stuff, right? But with those guys, I brought my easy stuff because I didn't want them to overload them. So that was the first time they had the freedom to improvise much more instead of just kicking those arrangements, because if you don't play it exactly the way like they played it, then your teacher is going to be mad with you. But with me, they could more improvise. They could put more of their own stuff into this. And they started to get the hang on it. And we didn't play just the 2 hours. We played till eight in the night until their lips were gone, you know, until everyone was finished. But this Johannes, he was standing right next to me because the saxophones are always in the front. And I thought, now, wait a minute, this can't be a 17-year-old with that a big tone, with a timing like a blues player from Texas.
Wow.
With a horn that's expressive. I mean, like, wow, you know. So I took his address, and then his dad told me, look, I wanted to play in the Galaxy Dreamband back in the 70s, and now you hire my son, you know, because... But the explanation was, since his dad wanted to play with us the Galaxy Dreamband stuff, you know, he had all the records at home. Mm-hmm. So Johannes was growing up with my music.
Okay.
See, and that made him, my saxophone player at the time, he had been playing with me 8 years. His name is Christian Weidner. I think maybe you remember him.
Yes, I do.
Fantastic player.
He's wonderful.
Alto saxophone. And he came after 8 years and said, hey, Gunther, it's great to play with you, but I want to do my own shit now. Well, I was set like Mingus was set when Dolphy said that to him, right? Uh-huh. But then on the other hand, I'm proud if this is happening. Because I don't want anyone playing my music. I want them to play their music with me, right? So, because I have room for that. I have room for characters. I'm not writing down a trumpet sound like Jill Evans maybe does, sound pictures. I need the human being in the horn. I need the spirit. I need the soul, body and soul. Here we go again. Yeah. So if 2 weeks after that, I had a duo concert with my breakdancer, Prince Alex from Russia. See, he and me, we can do what I can do with Mary, you know, with Jean. I can play duos, but he's not singing or playing, he's dancing. Mm-hmm. And his body is explaining what I'm doing, and I'm explaining with my music what his body is doing. In other words, we got something done what no one in history has done before. And total improvisation between a dancer and a musician. We go on stage without a tune. We just look at each other, listen to each other, and concentrate on each other, and then we do something which wipes out everyone who sees it. Because, see, in...
And that says a duo, not as an ensemble.
Well, I'm coming to that. Okay. I'm coming to that. But that gig, I have a whole ensemble working like this. Yeah. As a matter of fact, at this particular moment, I have a group with 4 musicians and 4 dancers.
Wow.
The youngest dancers are 16. We have 2 of those. And Prince Alex already is 30, and the other dancer is about 25. And let me go back to that gig. So I had this gig in the same city, and I said to Johannes, I'm going to be here in 2 weeks. I want you to play with us. So after the 2 weeks, we were coming into the city. It was a summer day. And Johannes came there, he was 17, he had his short pants on. And, you know, so he unpacks his instruments, and then he says, so what are we going to play? I said, we improvise. And then his feet started to tremble and all. So I said, just play what I'm playing. Because by the time you pick it up, I'm already in the next step, you know. So he looked at Prince Alex. Prince Alex looked at him, and we looked at each other. And then we had no rehearsal. We were going out on stage, and it went on, fantastic. I mean, everyone who was there, they didn't believe that we played for the first time together. You know. I knew this. He had the time of 7 or more years to check out my music from his dad's record collection. And his dad played them very often because he liked my music. So his dad is now very proud that his son could fulfill his dream mm-hmm. with me. And I hired him right away after this concert. And he still had to go another year to school. But even while he was in school, he already played because Christian Weidner had said, I want to do my own thing. I'm going. So we're talking about the energy and the forces.
Something leaves and something comes.
That's right. Or if you talk in biblical, in the sense of the Bible, I mean, God gives me, every time I need someone, puts them right there in front of me. I just have to recognize it. I mean, that's how, to me, the whole universe is happening right now. I never beg for anything, I never ask for anything, but there are certain things I seem to need as my next step in my life, mm-hmm. and it's right there. It's right there. I only have to recognize it. People, situations, whatever. You know. And that goes with me almost every day. If I just trust my goodness and not the devilishing, self-destructing thoughts. You know, if I can keep my energy together, then everything the universe is giving it to me because I obviously seem to be on a good track, you know. I can tap myself on the shoulder about what I already have been accomplished up so far, you know. I mean, not many people can show that great and plenty of work which I am doing or already have accomplished. But you see, my latest invention is that thing with the dancers. Because when I play with ballet people, ballet trained people, uh-huh. they always need to know 5, 6, 7, 8, 5, 6, 7, 8, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 1, 2, 3, 4. Any jazz dancer, they need the rhythms, and if you improvise, they are thrown off because it sounds different from the way you rehearsed with them. That really was never instant improvisation. We gave them the music, and we had to play it exactly the way like we had it in the rehearsal. When I talk, and I've worked with Nureyev, you've heard about Nureyev,
yes.
The great dancer.
Oh, yeah.
He did a solo piece on one of my compositions.
Oh, do you know which one?
I had, at that was a time, oh yeah, I had my 8th of July ready, mm-hmm. and I had my solo record ready, that dance, which is called Dances. Right.
Yes.
So you can see the connection of my music, which is a dance. Each of our group or solo improvisations comes out of the movements. So when I met this Prince Alex from Tajikistan, I mean, he's Russia, Tajikistan is even further down to China. It used to be with Russia, but they are not. So when we met and were aware what we both can do, we started to work. And we have been, like I told you, we have been doing it with duo, but this ensemble of mine with the dancers, we can do something what no one has really accomplished before, that we can improvise at the same time, off from each other, dance and music. Why? Because those break dancers, those hip hoppers, as we jazz musicians say, they feel the groove. So when we play to them, this is always a kind of groove. So they immediately cannot just only put their fingers to it, but they can improvise. Mm-hmm. Because breakdance has the same like ballet or jazz dance, a certain kind of vocabulary from which we can go.
Right.
Only the breakdance, and it still is, in the hands of the commercial industry, and they don't allow you to improvise. They don't allow you to do your own thing with it. I've shown my DVDs to some of the people here, and the first reaction was, "Oh, that figure is not right." I said, "It's not about the right figure. It's about what you as an improviser can do with the music we are doing." Because they don't know before what kind of music we're going to play. They don't know what we are going to play after they started to dance.
Right.
So they immediately have to be in tune with us, but we are in tune with them too, and we are changing our playing according to what they are talking with their bodies. Yeah. And with this ensemble, I'm doing my now famous children workshops. Because I think the real problem jazz music and improvised music and all our arts is having at this time is not that there is no work. There is no paid work because there is no audience. Mm. Because if there would be so many audiences demanding for it, there would be a lot of clubs changing their policies and hire jazz musicians.
Right.
So why don't we enlarge our audiences? Why don't we do everything we can to have more people tune in into our work? Because from when we sit in our places and cry because we don't have no work, no one is going to know about us. So that's why I started to do my children workshops. Because it's so effective what we are doing that our biggest fans right now, especially the band with the breakdancers,
yeah,
are the little ones. 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 years old. And that's the range where I teach from as early as possible. Because kids, see, we play music. We don't say we rock music or we whatever.
Right.
You know, we say we play music.
Mm-hmm.
And believe me, kids know what playing means.
Yeah.
Because that's all what they're doing all day, play. And now you give them something sensible to play, meaning improvise with each other. One is playing a percussion instrument, and the other one is answering on him too.
Mm-hmm.
Or they play together. Or I use as a routine, I take a basketball. I have a sitting in a circle, and the basketball is determining which of the in the circles sitting people is going to improvise. In other words, I roll the ball to someone, they take the ball, and then they improvise, and then they look who is going to be next. And since everyone could be the next, everyone is quiet and waiting that he can get the ball. The teachers say, how you get those kids being quiet? You know, so I'm using all the teaching strategies in order to bring this improvisation to them. And once they have the ball, they have the attention. Everyone is looking at them. So when they play, everyone is concentrating on them. And this way, they listen also very good. So this is how this guy or this girl, how they starting to, you see, I talk with them. I make pantomimes with them. Like one's coming, one of the kids is jumping on the stage and is making a frog. And then we all have to guess what that is, a frog. And then this girl or boy, they keep on going, leaping like a frog. And then I say, let's play with it. And every time they leap, the kids make brum or bam or dum 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 or whatever. So they're starting to have a visual thing also with it, you know. So they see that every of their bang bang bangs has a certain meaning when someone is moving to it or whatever. So this is why they learn so fast. Mm-hmm. I make conversations, calls and answers. I have them two of them. They are on stage. You see, we do a final concert after 3 days. Okay. They catch up within 20 minutes. They catch up the whole idea. Kids are so bright. It's unbelievable.
Have you done this in the States too, or just Germany?
I did this way back with Jean. We once had a workshop at the Guggenheim Museum.
Oh.
And there that was the time when I started to get this whole thing together. Because I had children of my own, you know, so I knew what these guys had in their minds all the time. And you see, after 3 days, they are so good that they can do a concert. I mean, we are with them on stage, but we are just like anyone else. We are not an orchestra and have them and play and they play with us. No, no, it's a real big ensemble, 25 children, and the music and dance company, that's what that is called. And also, I tell them about composing. You know, I go in the middle with a ball in my arm, you know, so I have the concentration, and I just point with my finger to someone who's supposed to improvise. So this little drum kit starts and plays, and then I get another one in, and then when one of those starts a rhythm, because all of a sudden one got some thing going, then I just put my finger over and make them aware that they should play with him. So they take all the rhythm of that kit. I'm not standing up there and say 1, 2, 3, 4. They don't know what that is. They don't have no concept about 1, 2, 3, 4 and then play a beat. You know, that's too far away from their thinking and their being. But if one of them starts a rhythm, then they all like to play that much more than if a grown-up comes and say, play this rhythm.
Right.
Yeah. So it's a very, very thought through thing how to give our improvisation to them, because that's what Jean and me have been doing in the last decades while she was alive, that we talk about energy, right, that we take this incredible creative energy which a jazz musician or a jazz band or an improvising poet or has, and give it to the children as an educational tool, because their concentration is there all of a sudden.
Right.
Their sense for unity in a group gets developed, their sense for the communication, and that music and dance can be a communication. They didn't know about it because the industry gives them all this not creative music, right? This commercial stuff. So, and they are so thankful. After half an hour with them, their eyes start to glow because they are excited. They're getting challenged, right? Yeah. And they get being taken serious too.
Yes.
They are important. You see, and they grow in those 3 days. They grow. And then I go in the middle and make a composition, I said. So I make a composition, I tell who is playing or not. So I let put him out or in, or the whole group, the whole section, or one. And so I'm the director at the moment. I'm not only the director, I'm the composer. I do instant composing with them. And then one of the kids gets the job. I give him the ball and he goes in the center. And then when we do our concert together at the end of the work of the workshop, and the parents come, and the whole room is filled with other kids who had heard about it, but they didn't enlist, so they couldn't be with us. You know. But they all want it because everyone is so excited. These kids, you know, and then when I have these great breakdancers with me who can do all that stuff, what the kids are also trying to learn. This is how I'm catching them, you know, because from the jazz music I couldn't catch them, but from this momentous which I create, I built a real band together. It's like I'm rehearsing a big orchestra with kids as musicians and dancers.
On that happy note, let's take a break for a sec so we can make a new track.